Hey everybody, this is Brett. Today, November 30th, 2011, last day, very last day of November. No 31 in November. So, anyway, today on the show, Lorette Lynn and I, Lorette Lynn of Unplug Mom, have a discussion with Dr. Robert Koonsman, a professor of education at Indiana University. Dr. Koonsman had done some research, as professors often do, his on the subject of homeschooling. He is in the education department at Indiana. He is a teacher of teachers. So he came to some conclusions, made some prescriptions, and that's what we're going to talk about on the show today. One of the important elements of our discussion on homeschooling, how much government oversight and regulation should there actually be here? You know what my answer is, but that's one of the subjects that we explore. I hope you like hearing Lorette on the show. I really like working with her. I think this is like maybe the third show we've done together, and we're probably going to do another one either in December or January. So it was actually Lorette who brought Dr. Koonsman's book to my attention. The title of that book, Write These Laws on Your Children. That's a biblical reference. And we'll get into that during the show. I think that's about it. Maybe one thing that I should point out, I played around with the editing of this show a little bit, and what you're going to hear first, the first 15 minutes or so, that's actually the last 15 minutes of this entire audio presentation as we recorded it. And it's just Lorette and me having a discussion about what we thought of our previous discussion with Dr. Koonsman. So you could kind of get maybe a little overview, a little introduction in the form of our recap. And then, you know, you can decide whether you want to listen to the whole show or not. I think that this is a topic that deserves more time and attention from me on this show. And that's it. I encourage you to go to unplugmom.com, check out Lorette's podcast. She's had some great guests, including my friend Jan Irvin from Gnostic Media. Jonathan Taylor Gatto has been on her show, so please go check it out. And she's, you know, she's very entertaining, very easy to listen to, so I hope you'll do that. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon. Bye.
Okay, Brett, final thoughts.
Well, I think that one of the things that's worth mentioning here is that we're, as far as a lot of these arguments, you know, who will intervene in neglect, who will intervene in abuse, it's worth recognizing that we're caught in kind of a vicious circle. And today, we do have several symptoms in this country, and I'm sure this is true elsewhere around the world, of a very unhealthy society. And I think that one of the reasons why we see that is because for so long, people have been forced into this culture of dependence and deference to authority. If you think about, you know, most examples of physical child abuse, it's a parent trying to make the argument from authority. Like, I'm bigger than you, so this is what happens.
Right.
You know, and that's accepted. I mean, the abusive parent sees that as a valid argument because that's the argument that was always used on them, because I said so, because I'm your parent, because that's the law. You know, the deference to authority is one part of it, but also the culture of dependence. People see things that look like child abuse or things that, you know, upset them when they see the way other parents speak to or treat their children, and they say that's somebody else's responsibility. That's somebody else's responsibility to intervene in that situation. Even though I'm a part of this community, somebody's getting paid to do that, you know, so I can just turn my back to it.
And that's how we've gotten here as a society, is that we've just become conditioned to doing this, to this kind of behavior, where we leave it up to somebody else and expect somebody else to run it and be in charge of it. And we're not taking responsibility.
Right, exactly.
So it falls on our hands then to come back and say, listen, this is my job. And I think, Brett, that the crux of it is there. And I know that we've had this discussion before, and, you know, we can't have it really enough times, is we have been reconditioned, okay, to believe that it is not our responsibility to help our children learn.
Mm-hmm.
we go through society and we become parents and we automatically assume that our children's education is not our deal. We need to send them away to have that done. And when we start even remotely considering something like home education, it scares the bejeebers out of us at first. And we think, I can't do that. I'm not set up to do that, which is kind of funny to me because we've been raised by the same school system that we now feel so unprepared to teach our own children, and yet we're sending them back into that school system.
And we would think, too, that, according to what most people believe to be education, why would they think they could do it? Because educating somebody, if the school is any indicator, takes 40 hours a week and costs $12,000 a year. So most parents are, how can I do that?
Right. And that's why when I'm coaching parents, I try to draw the distinction between schooling and education. Because if somebody says, I want to homeschool my kids, I tell them, you can't. You can't homeschool your kids. It is an overwhelming thing. I cannot homeschool my kids. Who wants to homeschool their kids? This is a huge responsibility. It's something huge to have to do because you're talking, like you said, 40 hours a week. I have to sit my kid down. I have to force feed them. I have to fight with them and make them do stuff that they don't want to do. This is going to take up all of my time. It's going to be completely stressful. The kid's going to throw things at me and reject everything. I'm going to have to figure out how to lump them together with 30 other kids their own age and make sure that they have peer pressure and spitballs at the back of their head. How am I going to provide that? Of course you can't do it. Can't homeschool. Don't try to. Schooling is the school's job, and they're doing a great job of ruining children all over the country. We are just parents. Mm-hmm. We're educating our children. We're helping them learn. We're just being parents. It's very natural, and that's the difference. But we've been so indoctrinated that we come to this point where our kid's 4 years old and say, okay, we're done. I don't know what to do here. We're going to leave it up to the government. And that's the problem. That's the problem now that we're even having the conversation of regulation, because we feel, well, you know, I might still F up, so I need the government to come in and make sure I'm not messing up.
Right. And those are the fantasies that I was talking about. This becomes, people's idealized vision of what the government can do. They need to look at it like, well, I'm setting a fire in the woods. What are the potential consequences of this? And unfortunately, it's a lesson that in every area people don't seem to learn. So we have this creeping along of, well, maybe just a little bit of government some of the time in this area. Well, that conversation is being had about 500 different things that affect society all the time. Maybe just a little bit more intervention here. And you can see what the consequences of that would be.
Well, it's like you mentioned the TSA before. We're having this problem with the TSA where they get to, fill up women's breasts and everything else for the sake of some illusion of safety. It's the same reason we let government interfere in education, for the sake of the illusion of intellect. But, look around. Like you were saying before, you turn on the TV, turn on a debate, and they're speaking to people on a seventh grade level. The intellect is indeed an illusion. The public education system, or the education system in general, is not really fostering any kind of intellectual curiosity or intellectual stimulation. So why are we letting them then control what we should and shouldn't learn as parents? I'm kind of just reiterating you. Clearly, we're on the same page.
Right. Yeah, I think that's just it speaks to the lessons of school. That first of all, obedience. And then, when most people go through that system and they're obedient, even a somewhat independent-minded person looks around and they say, well, geez, I better conform for the purpose of acceptance. When you require the permission or the advice or the intervention of authority and you're not asserting yourself as an individual in any aspect of your life, that results, I think, in just terrible apathy. So that's the function, accidental or intentional, of school. And I think that's the intentional function of school is obviously to serve the needs of the state. But these are the consequences, and that's the society that.
I think we have a pandemic of intellectual apathy is what's going on now, Brett. And I actually do think it was purposeful. And when we talk to people like John Taylor Gatto, as we talked about in the interview, and I know you've heard him speak before, he is revealing after 30 years in working in the public school system, he quit because he was no longer willing to hurt children, and that's a quote from him. And his contention is that it was, mm-hmm. it is very much on purpose. We have been dumbed down on purpose to be intellectually apathetic and, you know, reliant on conformity and obedient and docile, because as a population, we're much easier to control. And that's why we're able to see now, go into the airport and let people feel us up and let people do things for us, because we're so controlled by fear. We're terrified. Well, I don't know. I'm going to just let myself get abused here because I'm terrified that something bad might happen to me. And this is after years of indoctrination and causing this docile apathy. And I love that you use the word apathy. So I do think that there is something nefarious and purposeful going on there. Would you say?
I think so, too. And of course, I think we know so just from the research and looking at the Prussian model and how that was brought to the United States over 100 years ago and is well in place in the education system in this country. Now, of course, too, there's plenty of people who hear this kind of talk and they would say conspiracy. But I mean, just imagine, you have to think about the utility of it from any kind of management standpoint. You're not going to tell tens and eventually hundreds of millions of people that they're free and then have 50 to 100,000 people in charge of controlling them without seriously intervening in their thinking and giving them an acceptable box to think in that would not work any other way. So the illusion of freedom comes from putting the mind in a cage versus, you know, in like a more openly totalitarian society, just putting people in actual cages, even though there's plenty of that too.
It's the great illusion. And I want to bring up also, you're right, people would hear this and automatically many people would start saying conspiracy and kind of shut it out and put their hands up and, you know, the proverbial talk to the hand, I'm not hearing you. And it's the hear no evil, see no evil, speak no mm-hmm. evil thing. But this is also a very conditioned response, isn't it? People have been trained to hear stuff that challenges their own personal status quo and reject it because they're too afraid to think, okay, maybe there's some truth in that. So that is also a very conditioned response.
Yeah. And I think that most belief systems are relatively shallow in the fact that they're not built empirically. They're not built philosophically. They're built, again, with the argument from authority. I'm the person who knows what I'm talking about. You're the person who doesn't. I'll tell you what to think and what to believe. And maybe we'll sprinkle in some nice sounding things like, oh, you should ask questions, or everyone's entitled to their opinion. But no, the main hard narrative is the same. This is the range of thought that's acceptable. You need to stay within it or you will be labeled
right.
insane.
Well, we've been raised as a society over the last few decades in this ad hominem kind of philosophy or this behavior, ad hominem behavior, where it is, we just rely on authority. And this person said so, and so therefore it's true. And my teacher standing, I'm 8 years old, and my teacher standing in front of my room saying, this is how it is. And all 30 of us are nodding our head and saying, well, this must be how it is because she's the teacher and she knows. And then we get to high school. And if we start to question some of that and show that we have our own thoughts, we're often pegged as troublemakers. And we're told that we're messing with things and we have behavior problems. And when I was growing up, we were just told that we were bad kids and we were rejected. Now they have a more efficient way of dealing with that, and that's by drugging the children to make them comply. So you just kind of get out of high school then after all these years of accepting authority's word as the doctrine, that when somebody challenges that out in the real world, quote unquote, when somebody challenges that, you, after having been indoctrinated for 20 years of your life, you say, no, that's messing with my status quo. That's messing with what I believe to be true. My teacher didn't tell me that. The history book didn't tell me that. Therefore, what you're saying is conspiracy. And then I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to make you out to be an idiot. And I'm going to call you names and I'm going to call you foolish. And I'm going to call you a right-wing nut job or a liberal maniac. And I don't have to believe you. And this is the way we've been trained.
Right.
And this is what I think people need to break free from. And that's why I actually think school is dangerous. And I don't think they should be regulating us because it's dangerous.
Oh, yeah. It's extremely dangerous. And I think that the whole, you know, the whole undertone of or the what's underneath everything that we discussed there is like how could if looking at what these people do. One thing that we didn't talk about was statistics. If you looked at the stat sheets that were linked to that website, or what was that organization, NCES?
That's the government education, you know. So if we're talking about unbiased statistics, right. You can't get more biased than that.
Yeah, and we see this kind of Soviet model of trying to quantify quality, where human beings wind up being discussed in the same way that Car and Driver magazine discusses pickup trucks, right? Outperforming, you know, this or that. And I think that the attempt to quantify quality always winds up in is sort of like a recipe for the growth of bureaucracies. Like, oh, we just need to do more to have, you know, all these beans in this pile. How we to fit with the plan that we set up based on previous bean counting exercises. There is problem is compared to what, right? When we're talking about home education, compared to what the government school system, I think that's entirely foolish.
The point of reference here is irrelevant, really. We're dealing with two things that have nothing mm-hmm. to do with each other. Brett, we're a little bit short of time, so I'm going to have to end this as much as I really don't want to, because I got to tell you, I really love working with you. You're a trip. You're awesome.
Thanks, Lorette. You too. I think that this is great, and there's plenty more we can do in the future.
Okay, so here is the rest of the discussion.
Hello, this is Lorette Lynn, the Unplugged Mom. And I am here, as always, to talk you right out of your comfort zone. And we're going to do that today with Professor Robert Kunzman from University of Indiana School of Education. What is so special about Professor Kunzman? Well, Professor Kunzman has done an extensive amount of research on homeschooling and home education and what it means to the world of education in general. He has strong opinions about whether or not it is a viable option to or alternative to public education. We're going to discuss that as well as his book, which was recently published, called Write These Laws on Your Children. Professor Kunzman, welcome to Unplugged Mom Podcast.
Well, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us about first, what exactly is it that you do? You are a professor of what?
Well, I teach in the Department of Curriculum Instruction here at the IU School of Education. So I spend some time preparing teachers for secondary education, so middle school and high school teaching. And then I also work with graduate students, particularly around issues of moral and civic education.
Okay, so you teach teachers?
I do.
Okay, very good. What was it that prompted you to do research on homeschooling?
Well, my own research studies sort of the intersection of religion, citizenship, and American education. And a few years ago, a group called Generation Joshua, which I write about in the book, caught my eye. It's a civic education program for homeschoolers, particularly conservative Christian homeschoolers. And so I got interested in studying a little bit about them, and that sort of drew my attention into the homeschooling movement, so to speak, more broadly.
Okay. So would it be safe to say that you were concentrating on conservative Christian homeschooling?
That's right. Yeah, the book focuses on six conservative Christian homeschool families, although I think that the overall survey takes a broader look at homeschooling as well, but that's my particular interest.
Okay. You mentioned on the website that you felt that there wasn't any unbiased or nonpartisan research out there for people to find out about homeschooling or what homeschooling is. Would you say that the research that you're providing and the information you're providing is, in fact, the unbiased and nonpartisan research that you want to present to the world?
What I meant when I created the website was to try and provide a clearinghouse for research, and most of the research websites that are out there come from an advocacy perspective. And so I think there's plenty of actual research that is done by all sorts of folks that I think is worthwhile and useful and certainly thoughtful. So I certainly don't want to set myself up as the person who's coming in and trying to provide that for everyone, but rather just providing a place that people can go and sift through what's out there.
Right.
And so in terms of my own work, certainly it comes from a perspective, and I certainly have starting assumptions like everyone else. And so I think that for instance, someone reading the book would have to make a judgment as to whether or not they felt as though I were being, fair and respectful and trying to present a variety of perspectives.
Okay. Now, tell us just a little bit about the book. The name of the book is Write These Laws on Your Children, and this is centered around, again, conservative Christian homeschooling movement.
That's right. The title of the book actually came from a comment that a mother made to me, and that actually several homeschool families made to me in different ways. They're referring to a passage in the biblical book of Deuteronomy, which talks about raising one's children and essentially writing the laws of God on their hearts. And this is, in essence, the primary motivation for a lot of these conservative Christian homeschool families in terms of their decision to homeschool and how they go about doing it. I spent a couple of years traveling around the country, visiting with six families and spending time with them, talking to them about what they were doing and why they were doing it and watching them while they were doing it and trying to really present portraits of what they do and then adding my own commentary and analysis as a part of that story.
Okay. Well, right now, I'd like to ask you a little bit about that research and what some of your findings were.
The main thing that stands out to me, and this, I think, crosses well beyond what you might call the conservative Christian homeschooling universe, is that homeschool parents, by and large, I found, feel as though it is their place, their right to direct and shape the upbringing and education of their children. And ultimately, they feel as though that is their role, and oftentimes that it's exclusively their role. And that, to me, is the one sort of common thread that runs through regardless of the ways that people decide to do their homeschooling.
All right. Well, let's springboard from that then. What is your that's your finding, and, I would agree with that. Most of us feel that it's ultimately our right to educate our children in the way we see fit. What is your opinion on that? Like, how does Professor Kunzman feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly am sympathetic to that, and as a parent, I feel the same way that it's my primary responsibility. I think probably where some of the arguments arise is whether or not that right or interest is absolute, and whether there are any other stakeholders in that arrangement. And I think that's where a lot of the arguments arise around, should the state have any say in that? Should children have any say in that? And that's I think, where the arguments start to get parsed around regulation.
Right. And that's actually something that I want to get into a little bit more with you, but I want to cover some other basic ideas first. When you were doing your research, and we know now that your research was primarily focused on conservative Christian home education, did you find, though, that this made up the majority of the homeschool population?
Well, there's really no way that we know. We don't have any comprehensive statistics around homeschoolers, the number, who they are, what their motivations are. We have some large-scale surveys, but they're guesstimates at best. And so I think that the way that I usually frame it is that there's usually fairly common agreement among researchers that conservative Christians constitute the largest subset, but that may not be a majority. Some groups, such as the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, would certainly assert that they are the vast majority. Others would say that that's not the case. But certainly, conservative Christian homeschoolers and an advocacy group like HSLDA has the highest profile publicly and carries probably the most political weight when it comes to regulation and public discourse around homeschooling.
Well, I think that's what most people automatically assume when they hear, the mainstream folks anyway, would assume that homeschooling is majorly comprised of conservative Christians and that it's a conservative Christian movement. But when you're in the world of home educating, as I am, and I've been doing this for 10 years, you realize that there are a growing number of secular families that are home educating. And it's not only Christian, and it's not only different religions, but there are those of us out there that aren't religious at all. So we're not doing it for religious reasons whatsoever. And according to the NCES document that I'm looking at right now, which was from 2003, it's really the third reason 29% chose to home educate to provide religious or moral instruction. The first reason was that they were concerned, or we are concerned, about the environment of school or dissatisfaction with academic instruction. So it seems like, more importantly, we're worried about the social and academic problems more so than the religious problems. Not saying that there aren't conservative Christians out there that are homeschooling for those reasons. I know that there are, but there are actually more home educators that are not home educating for that reason. And that's what I'd like to become a little bit more well known. And I think you mentioned that the statistics, it's hard to really judge because the statistics are lacking. And you mentioned on your website too that a lot of this is because a lot of the home education families out there don't participate in the surveys. They don't want to participate in the surveys. You're not clear on whether or not you approve of that or not, though. And I don't know if I sense like an undertone of dissatisfaction with the fact that we won't cooperate with the with the statistics. So I was just wondering, I'd just like to point out, I guess, the reasoning behind that is we have made a purposeful and deliberate decision to not be part of the system. We don't feel that it's a beneficial experience for our children. We don't feel that it's a beneficial experience for our family. And we want to do things differently than conventional mainstream education. So we don't want to participate in the surveys, and we don't want to participate in the statistics. And we don't believe that it's really any of society's business what we're doing inside of our own doors. So that's when we come back to the whole regulation thing and who has a stake in it, as you said, whether or not it's society's responsibility. And I will get back to that, but I want to just, for the sake of our audience, I've seen the webpage already, but for the sake of our audience, your findings as far as home education. We've already determined that they're not all conservative Christian, that it just seems like this is majority, okay?
I just wanted to add one point of clarification around that statistic you cited from the 2003 survey, which is fairly similar to the 2007 survey. They asked what the most important reason was, but they also asked what the variety of reasons were. And when they asked what the variety of reasons were, they actually had more than 80% pointed to providing religious or moral instruction. And that was on par with a concern about the environment of other schools. And in the 2007 survey, religious and moral instruction was actually the most important reason. But I think that all it says to me is that they're all in the mix there. And I would certainly agree with you that the homeschool movement is broad and diverse. And certainly to peg it as simply a conservative Christian, or even predominantly that, would be a mistake. There's no question.
Okay.
I think one thing that's worth adding too, right here, is that's kind of a broad categorization. Saying
absolutely.
Religious and moral instruction. Religion and morals are certainly not synonyms. Sometimes they're actually antonyms.
Sure.
That's why I think
it's such a big question mark.
Right.
Getting back to the type, we've already covered whether or not you feel that there's a particular type of home educator, and you've said that they're broad. Have you been able to determine that home educators in general are often more prone to criminal activity or child abuse?
Oh, no, there's no data that would support that contention.
Okay. Would you say that this is a legitimate way of educating children?
I absolutely. It certainly can be, as well as a variety of other choices. I think that the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. And certainly there are many, many cases of where homeschooling is a great option for many kids.
And as far as education in general, how would you, as a professor or in your experience, define education? Is that a subjective term, or is there a definite definition of education?
I think it really varies. I think that one of the distinctions that has been made over the past couple of hundred years is the distinction between education and schooling, right? This sort of formal, more institutional process. But I think that's one of the aspects of the definition that sometimes, or oftentimes, homeschoolers would like to contest and say that, they may not be as interested in formal certainly not institutional schooling, but they're certainly interested in this broader notion of education and the way that everyday life is involved in that process as well and can be incredibly enriching for their children.
Right. Well, it goes back to the thought that perhaps math and spelling and reading and the academics, not that I personally feel that these things are important, but there is probably a family out there or many families out there that as important as these things are, perhaps learning how to run the family business is their definition of education. And this is something that's important to this family and something that's important to the child. And therefore, they're still getting an education. They're just not getting the same education that society would define for them. And yet they're going to go on and continue to be successful people in their lives. So that's why I think that this is very, very much up to the individual family and the individual family's dynamic and needs and concerns and moral and ethical beliefs.
I would agree. I think there are a lot of ways to become educated. There's no question.
Let's get to society's responsibility. Let's talk about that a little bit because regulation is something that I wanted to talk to you about. I have something here from you, and this was in relation to an article about a tragedy that happened with a particular child in New Jersey. And I have here, I'm going to go ahead and read it. This is something that you contributed to the article. Homeschool supporters could compromise a little more and not lose the autonomy they cherish, said Professor Robert Kunzman of the Indiana University School of Education, who has conducted research and written a book on the homeschooling movement. Kunzman supports requiring homeschool children to be registered with the state and to undergo periodic basic skills testing to measure literacy and simple math proficiency. Those requirements strike a balance between a parent's desire for autonomy and society's right to know children are protected in the rare cases of abuse and neglect. If families are doing these horrific things to their kids, we are going to catch them in basic skills testing, he said. Kunzman said he was not familiar with the Irvington case, but in general said religious homeschooling parents are most sensitive to concerns about government interference. They see educating their children as a fundamental right given to them by God, he said. There's a lot of good ways to get educated, and the state should not be prescribing the minute details for what that means for every kid. There is a role that the state ought to play in a very minimal way that is not terribly intrusive. Now, I have some questions about this. First of all, yes, you are correct that, but it's not only Christians that feel that it's our right to home educate. Christians would say it's our right given to us by God. The secular population would say it's just our right, period. And we don't really understand the reasoning why we should subject to any kind of government interference. And I like the fact that you state that the state should not be prescribing the minute details for what education means for every family, but you also say there is a role that the state ought to play in very minimal ways. What is that role? What role do you feel the state ought to play? And that, of course, suggests that you feel that society does have a right to dictate, society at large does have a right to dictate to some degree how we're educating. And I just want to explore that with you, ask you why you feel that way and what you feel those minimal ways should be.
Right. Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I think I would probably use the, maybe it's semantics, maybe not, but the idea of protect rather than dictate in the same way perhaps that you might talk about the role that society has in protecting children from child abuse in the family, right? That most of us, I think, would say that there is a role that society has in stepping in when children are being physically abused. And so I think that most of us see that there is some role that the state has in some circumstances with the family. To my mind, an important question is, you know, what are the basic interests, basic educational interests of children? And, you know, there are a variety of things that people propose, but I think that if you're going to talk about the state trying to protect those, you also have to raise the question, is the state capable of doing that? Is the state wise enough, so to speak, to do that? And I think those are legitimate concerns, many of which homeschoolers raise. And so, you know, I think that to me, the one area that is fairly or certainly relatively clear-cut in terms of a general agreement that children have a basic educational interest, and that's to be able to read and write and do basic math. And I think that that's the type of interest that the state would also have the basic capacity to be able to, so to speak, check up on. And that's where the basic skills testing comes in. I'm not a fan of saying that, that homeschoolers need to follow state curriculum, that they need to have, you know, all sorts of these arguably obscure, you know, content standards mastered or things like that. I don't think that's the state's role. And I think there's reasonable disagreement about whether those things are essential in education. But I do think that there is a pretty good consensus that basic literacy and numeracy are important for self-sufficiency for kids to become self-sufficient adults. And so I think that, that a way that, that that could be done with without being intrusive, without dictating curriculum, without saying what needs to go into the education, simply saying that, well, whatever you do, what comes out of it, one of the things needs to be that they need to be able to be literate and to be able to do basic math. So that's really where that rationale is coming from.
Okay, there are a couple of different, I want to kind of separate the two ideas here. We have society's role in ensuring that the our citizens are educated, and then we have society's role in ensuring that the kids aren't being abused. And I want to separate those two ideas, and I have reasoning for doing that because I think we have to focus on the two of them separately. So let's first take, let's leave the abuse for a second. Well, you know what, let's tackle abuse first. You said that society does have a role, and most people would agree that society does have a role, and the state certainly does have a role to step in when a child is being abused. And I agree with that. Nobody wants to see child abuse, all right? Anyone that says that they're okay with a parent abusing their child because it's their business, I don't technically agree with that. That's not okay. But the key word here is when. When they are being abused, the state has a right to step in when the child is being abused, not before, because that would be preemptive and that would assume guilt and put the burden of proof on the parent to constantly prove their innocence by reporting to the state, see, I'm not abusing my child. See, I'm not abusing my child. See, I'm not abusing my child. Public school parents and traditionally school parents are not subject to this because they feel, well, we already have our eye on them because they're in our classroom and we can see them and we can see if they have any bruises or scars. Now, I'm going to go ahead and ask Brett because Brett is a little bit better versed than I am in what's going on in the public school system today because he was he is a former teacher and his research is based in that. Can you tell me, Brett, if children are safe in the school system? Is that a guarantee that they're not being abused? Are they being watched?
Oh, no, absolutely not. And I think one of the real problems that we deal with in the confines of the, you know, the school buildings is some really rough, at times, peer-to-peer abuse, which, in my opinion, is the result of the forced associations that these kids have to tolerate for 35 hours a week. That kind of environment engenders that peer-to-peer abuse, which we call, you know, when kids do it, we call it bullying. So, and I think that when you look at other places where peers are trapped together, their social interactions tend to be generally negative. So I think that that's perhaps the biggest danger that students face in schools. I don't think that that's, you know, people have tried to do the whole what's wrong with kids today argument, and I really think that that's a product of the environment. I don't think that that's a new phenomenon. Another safety issue is if children have trouble for whatever reason fitting into the mold or conforming to the expectations of the school, even if they're highly gifted, they're often labeled as defective and wind up on some kind of drugs, which is a problem that is increasing in frequency.
Well, what about parental abuse, though? Because I think that's what we're focusing on here is parental abuse. And by the reasoning, when we say that we need to regulate home educators to make sure that the children aren't being abused, by that standard and by that reasoning, we're assuming that the function of school is not only to provide an education, but to also ensure safety. So safety from their own parents. So is there no child abuse? Do we not see child abuse within the school system?
Oh, no, of course, I think. And I can't imagine that there's any effective way that schools could monitor that or intervene in that, in my opinion.
Well, here's the thing. There are already laws on the books that protect children. Okay. And we do the best we can as a society, but then there becomes that line of crossing the line from just making sure that people get punished when they do abuse children and crossing the line into preemptive. We're going to assume that you're going to abuse your children. So we're going to monitor you and force you to prove that you're not. And this is the problem, Professor Kugelman, that I have with regulation for this when people use that reason as a point of reference for regulation, and they say, well, we need to regulate the home educating families to make sure they're not abusing their children. And my first response is, why would you assume that we are abusing our children? And you've already said that there is no conclusive research, there's no data at all that would suggest that we're more prone to criminal activity than any other family. So why do we especially need to be monitored? That's my question.
Right. Well, I think that it is important to make a distinction here between the two examples, because I'm not advocating that there's any special regulatory framework in regards to child abuse. I mean, it's the same, you know, it's the same mechanism regardless of whether it's a public school or homeschooled child, in terms of you know, child services getting involved through, you know, referrals or things of that nature. So I'm not actually arguing for anything different for homeschoolers in that regard. But I do think that you raise an important point, certainly one that's been raised in the research around this idea of testing as sort of a preemptive evaluation, so to speak, of children. And I do think that there is a difference there in regards to abuse versus educational neglect. And this idea that in order to, I mean, schools, for instance, they also test and evaluate students, and they provide evidence one way or another as to whether or not students are learning. And certainly, you know, I would be, you know, remiss if I were to say that schools always do a great job with educating children as well. And certainly, you know, many of the statistics that were cited already point to the fact that schools are far from perfect places. But I think that as in schools where students are assessed and the goal is to say students are either meeting these standards, whatever the school has said, or they're not, and then we need to do something about that, the same idea would hold true for protecting these, you know, basic educational interests of children, of saying that they need to be able to read and write. And to me, what I'm advocating is I would see as much less intrusive and much less bothersome to most homeschoolers than much of the regulations that are out there across the country, which I think are oftentimes a waste of time and resources for everyone involved.
Well, I have to agree with that. It certainly is a waste of time. But let's then focus on the abuse of educational neglect. Okay, we've covered the whole, we can't just automatically assume that parents are beating their children, and I think we can both agree to that. That's preemptive, and that assumes guilt and forces us to prove our innocence on a regular basis. And we're thinking of the extreme of actually physically beating our children. But there's also the consideration of, and I've heard this phrase tossed around a lot, educational neglect. Now, I live in Oklahoma, and in this state there is no regulation whatsoever, and we're happy about it that way. And I can also point out that even living here in the Bible Belt, in kind of the heart of the Bible Belt here, there are still many, many families here that are secular. So that kind of just really points to that whole statistic and blows it out of the water as well. However, let's go on to educational neglect. Every year in legislation season, this comes up, because that is probably the biggest argument, is that we need to impose regulation on the parents and we need to monitor, because the school needs to make sure and the state needs to make sure through the school district that there is no educational neglect going on there. Now, this still, to me, is preemptive, because number one, it assumes that we're guilty of neglecting our children educationally and forces us to have to prove that we're doing it. This, to me, is unconstitutional, because there is actually no real law that says that we need to provide a specific kind of academic education, and if we don't, we're criminals. So it assumes that there is a golden mean and a measure. And if there is, what is that golden mean? What is that measure? By whose measure do we have to live up to? And by whose definition of education? Because in order for there to be regulation, there has to be a standard. Where is that standard? Okay, what is the standard? And if there is a standard and there is a measure and we want all of the children to be able to perform to that measure, is that not totalitarian? And if that's not totalitarian, why not? Because to me, that screams of groupthink philosophy. We want you to all learn this, and we want to make sure you're all learning it in this way and according to these standards. And if you're not, we're going to ensure that you are, or we're going to assume that your parents aren't doing a good enough job, and we're going to call it educational neglect. So there's a very fine line here between trying to make sure that children are safe and invading on personal freedom. Now, in the case of educational neglect, we're saying we want to make sure that they're not being neglected. We're assuming that not having a particular brand of academic education is in fact equivalent to neglect or abuse. And that's when we think that it becomes society's responsibility. And that's what confuses me. What is the golden mean, and who gets to decide what that golden mean is and why?
Right. Well, from a legal standpoint, which is where you started with this, the Supreme Court has made it clear that the state does have a role in regulating schooling.
Schooling. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it does have a role in regulating schooling, and schooling and education not necessarily synonymous. That's the issue that I have. So that's what I want to explore.
Right. The Supreme Court has made a distinction in a way that they have acknowledged fundamental rights of parents constitutionally, but they've made a distinction between that and schooling. And so where this gets tricky, particularly with homeschoolers, and something that I've been writing about recently, is that, as you said, that there isn't necessarily a strong, clear distinction drawn between education more broadly and formal schooling. But in terms of federal law, that distinction does exist, and the state has a role to regulate. Now, I as I've said before, I very much agree with you that you use the phrase a certain brand of education, and I also would not support the state prescribing that, and I don't think that case law supports that. So where I'm coming from with this, you know, basic skills testing is saying that how you get there and all the other things that you choose to do with the educational process are really a matter for parents to decide as they shape the upbringing of their children. But one of the things that I think we all should be able to agree on, I hope, is that students should be able to know how to read and write and at least a basic level. And so that certainly is within the realm of case law for Supreme Court decisions, is that level of oversight is certainly constitutional.
Well, yeah, you know, I actually agree that, me personally, I agree that children, that it benefits children to be able to read and write, but I can't go against my own basic philosophy, which is that of personal and individual freedom, and dictate that all children need to be able to learn to read and write. I'd like it. I think it would be utopian. I think it would be wonderful if every child learned how to read and write, but I can't enforce myself on other families.
Right. That would be the hub of our disagreement right there, is that I would say that children themselves have certain interests and rights in that regard, and that for parents to make those decisions for their children that essentially compromise the children's capacity to be able to learn how to read and write is a violation of those. And so that I think is probably, if there's anything that we disagree about fundamentally today, that would be it.
We agree that children, it's nice if children learn how to rewrite, but I think we're disagreeing on the fact that I feel that it's not my place to impose myself on the families that don't do that, and would say that it is society's right to impose themselves on families that neglect to do that.
That's right.
And I also think, too, that there's some language that needs to be cleared up here, and I just want to speak on my own experience working with homeschoolers in the past. A great way to get a child to be not interested in reading and writing, just like a great way to get a child to not be interested in physical activity or physical fitness, is to force them to do it, is to make it part of a forced routine, because nothing that is brought about by the use of force or the use of consequences and rewards for doing so is really going to be very enjoyable to anyone. I think that this word education, which this institution of schooling over the last century has been superimposed on, is really worth looking at as far as definitions are concerned a little bit more closely. Even the etymology of that word education is about leading out, taking the natural gifts that young people have and bringing them into use. And I think that often people within education or who are supporting the government education system, even if they don't come out right out and say it, they're often looking at children as sort of these inanimate lumps that need to be activated by this so-called education, which is just has a schooling superimposed on it. My big concern with these standards for these basic skills, like reading, writing, and arithmetic, is timetables. I have worked with people in the past who homeschool who would be, under this current definition of educational neglect, be guilty. Because let's say a student spent 2 years in public school and was forced to do arithmetic, and through that use of force developed a very negative attitude, and is now 9 years old and is not ready to go back and explore or learn about math quite yet because of the negative experiences that he had in school. So if a child can't multiply, let's say, by the age of 10, what are the standards? What are the timetables? Does that constitute educational neglect? And I think that's just a dangerous door to leave open at all, that it should be the state's role. And again, let's not conflate the state and society, because I think those are two very different things, but it should not be the state's role to regulate when these things should be happening.
Well, also, just to include more to explore in the conversation, and I'd like to hear your comments on this, Professor Kunzman. Let's take, for example, what if a child is taught to build houses, to farm, and other useful functions, but is not taught to read by the time that they're 10 years old, but yet they know how to build a house, which most kids don't know how to do. How do we define which is more useful than the other, and who are we to have the right to decide that? What about groups like the Amish, who don't follow state regulations, but yet have a thriving and successful society? This is the problem with placing the standard and golden mean on a particular group in society and saying, okay, the government's now in charge of this carte blanche, and they get to decide that a child needs to learn how to read in this way by a particular age. So we're saying that that's not as useful as some of these other skills, you know, and isn't that subjective? Isn't that up to us to decide?
Well, I certainly think that there's plenty of room for, you know, reasonable disagreement about the relative importance of different life skills. But I do think that being able to read is a fundamental skill that gives children becoming adults many, many more options in their life, and really it arguably improves the quality of their life more generally to be able to read. And I think that you'd be hard pressed to find a lot of people who would disagree with that. And I think that portraying it as sort of the government deciding this, I think part of the reason we're having this conversation is that we as the people have to come to some agreement upon what we would say is a general consensus about what are some of the essentials for becoming educated in our modern society. And certainly there are going to be some people that always disagree, but I don't think it's some, you know, faceless bureaucrat somewhere, you know, handing down saying everyone must read and all of us saying, well, we don't agree with that. The way that I would frame the argument is I think that there's general consensus around that. And while there are certainly outliers, I would say that at some point there needs to be some recognition that for children's interests, they need to have someone say, this is important for them to be able to do to give them a future that has a variety of options in it.
Right. Well, that's another kind of area that we kind of gets into politics then, because then we're saying there needs to be a general consensus, and there probably already is a general consensus, but we're still talking about, and again, I think it's important to learn how to read, but I'm not going to impose myself on others that might not. Now, while the majority may agree that it's important, you know, that some things are important, if we're going to use the example of reading, but while the majority may agree on one thing, that is still a form of collectivism, because we're going with the majority opinion instead of respecting our own individual wants and desires. And then we have the totalitarian collectivism, which is something that not everybody agrees with politically or socially. So that forces maybe the minority, the 5% or 10% of people that don't agree with that kind of philosophy, that still forces them to capitulate.
What if it were 1% or 0.5%? Would you still say it would be forcing them?
Well, that 1% still represents a human being. Is that human being any less valuable than the collective?
Well, okay, so then when we talk about... Right.
That's a philosophical question.
Yeah, but when we talk about child abuse, right, you were quite clear that was a non-negotiable for you. So what about the perspective of someone who doesn't think that's a problem? I mean, is that collectivism as well? What's the distinction?
I don't understand the question.
You talk about, if anyone would disagree with the state making certain laws or regulations, that then it's a form of forced collectivism. But at the same time, you know, I think we were in strong agreement that the state should prevent child abuse and should step in that case. So how is that not sort of a forced collectivism as well?
Well, we're talking about two different things. We're talking about criminal activity.
Well, who decides what's criminal, though?
Exactly. Exactly. Who decides what criminal activity is? That's the point. Exactly. Now, the deciding factor in America on what criminal activity is and what the law is the Constitution of the United States. That is the supreme law of the land. And unless we can find something in the Constitution of the United States that specifically dictates and defines what education is and whose job it is, then we can't assume that it's the job of a government. Now, yes, it is we the people, but there has to be a representative we the people, and that is the government. And the public education system, which we have set up now to monitor children in school districts and in states where regulation is imposed, these parents have to report to the local school district. So the school district is still basically in charge of how the homeschooling parents are doing. And this is actually a question I have for you, Brett. This always confused me, because here we have a school system that these parents have specifically chosen to leave because they felt that the school system was not going to do a good enough job either academically, socially, or morally. And now they're being forced to still submit to that same school system, that failing school system. And this is, of course, another conundrum, because now we have a Board of Education who is really not doing that good of a job teaching children. And that brings up the question, too, what do we do when children do not get a proper education within the school system? If we can all agree, 100% of us can agree that children do need to learn how to read and write, and there is a particular standard. We know that the school system isn't necessarily providing that all the time. In a lot of schools around the country, we all know education is a problem. So what do we do when the children do not get a proper education within there? Should teachers then be subject to regulations or criminal proceedings? This is why this is such a philosophical conundrum. And we can have Brett kind of... I mean, what kind of condition are the schools in, Brett? I don't know. I'm not in them. You were. Do we have proper education going on there? Is there still a golden mean in there that they should be the ones that are regulating us?
Well, I think that part of the mythology of school and government is that the people do somehow regulate it. And I think we, at this point, most people who have paid attention to politics and current events can agree that the people really have no say in either of those institutions in any way that's efficacious. There's plenty of systems and routines and rituals that are set up to trick people into thinking they're participating. Like when it comes to education, you can go to a PTA meeting and you can be heard and you can run for the school board. And just like politics, I think that most of the things that could really affect change, you're talking about an incredible amount of time and money and resources and organizing to actually ever see anything happen. So people are not participating in these institutions. And I think what's worth clarifying as far as my philosophy and my position, sometimes it's hard to discuss these issues without sounding like politicians, like we have a plan or we want to institute a change that's immediate. I think that you would agree with me, Lorette, that we're, as far as the education system and the state's involvement in it is concerned, we're talking about a gradual evolution over time, and I think that now is the time where that conversation needs to start. The first thing that you do is not remove the bureaucracy that deals with intervening in child abuse, even though I think that from my experience working in years ago, working in a residential school where kids would come to us after being wards of the state or even in foster care, is that bureaucracy is not effective and completely out of control, the, you know, Child Protective Services. So kids would be taken out of their homes for what was considered abuse. Could be something as simple as the parent smokes marijuana. They're put in foster care where children are abused physically, emotionally, or sexually. They're removed from foster care and put in a residential school and then put on drugs. So let's not pretend, like when we say how would child abuse be dealt with effectively without the state, let's not pretend that by and large it's being dealt with effectively right now. How would education work without the state? Let's not pretend that it's being dealt with effectively right now. So we're kind of starting from scratch. We have these state institutions that don't work, that often lead to more abuse. And from my experience working with kids under 10, as far as the reading question is concerned, one of the biggest obstacles to them learning how to read effectively has been the schools and has been what I spoke about before, which is the idea that this is something that's being imposed upon you. So why would it be enjoyable? Why would it be fun? Why would it be something that you want to seek out on your own? And I think that education itself is about helping children, at the very most, tap into the natural gifts they have, you know, curiosity especially, that will make them into self-teachers. School is not about that. School is not about leading gifts and talents out of children. It's about having them sit still and putting information into them. Like I said, the young kids that I've worked with, it seems like their obstacles to learning how to do math or learning how to read has been the fact that it was imposed on them when they're at an age and they're in a mindset where they'd rather be doing something else.
Professor Kunzman, do you have any?
I wouldn't disagree with the importance of education being intrinsically motivated, and I think that, you know, again, I'm not interested in prescribing the method or the curriculum or lack thereof for homeschooling, and I think again that when you talk about, you know, basic skills as outcomes, you're not getting into intrusion on how that occurs. So I guess, you know, I wouldn't have any disagreement in that regard. I think also going back to something mentioned a couple of minutes ago that I'd like to just throw in there, you know, in terms of who would be responsible for monitoring, overseeing, evaluating any sort of homeschool regulation. From my perspective, it's probably better that it not be the local district and certainly not a local school district in and of itself. I mean, I think that homeschoolers need to be involved in this as well, and I think they need to be able to speak out of their own experience and perspective when, you know, for instance, if a child routinely fails these, you know, basic skills tests, if they were to do that, it's not necessarily, to my mind, an automatic conclusion that homeschooling has failed them. There may be all sorts of other educational challenges, special needs, mitigating circumstances. I think that all it does is say, well, let's take a closer look and let's try and talk about this and see if the educational experience is being attended to.
Well, I can appreciate that, because that certainly does sound like a reasonable compromise and put more power back in the home education population. However, it's still assuming that there needs to be some sort of golden mean, even if it's not the education system that says we have these basic skills tests. Who's putting out the basic skills tests and what are they really measuring? That's really the deeper question that I think we need to look at. Now, I can agree that we don't have to live with absolutes. Like, either we just completely leave it alone and we don't think about it at all, or we have complete control. There is a reasonable compromise there, because I understand that most of us are after the same thing. We're after improving the overall quality of America, but we have to also recognize that there is going to be variety and there is going to be difference. So even if the regulation had nothing to do with the school board and homeschoolers were self-regulated, we're still being regulated. And that means that the family down the street that homeschools gets a stake in saying what age my child should learn how to read, or whether they should spend more time, you know, running their own business or working on a farm or whatever. And, you know, the idea is just the idea that someone gets to dictate that You know, and like I said, it sounds really reasonable to say, yes, we need to absolutely make sure that every child knows how to read by the age of 9. That sounds great, but it is sort of an invasion of privacy. So it does bring up a little bit of a dilemma there, because on the one hand, you're like, well, we don't want an idiotic nation. We don't want a nation of adults that's running around not being able to read. Now, that's a little bit of a broad assumption, because we're assuming that kids are not going to want to learn how to read unless we force them, which just is simply not true. And I have a quote here from Linda Dobson that covers this a little bit, and she actually is paraphrasing Thomas Jefferson. She says, Thomas Jefferson said, it is better to tolerate that rare instance of a parent's refusing to let his child be educated than to shock the common feelings by forcible transportation and education of the infant against the will of his father. He also figured his list of 6 objectives would be accomplished in 3 years with ample time for students to go help in the family fields if needed. But then again, he was dealing with a primarily non-schooled populace that was 97% literate. Due to schooling, that is not the case today. And I think that's very, very important when we talk about basic skills and standardized testing. We're still going back to the idea of, well, homeschoolers need to be regulated to make sure they're performing like the schools are performing, but the schools aren't performing. And we do have a dumber nation now than we did 50, 60 years ago. So we're faced with a real society dilemma here.
And it's not just actual literacy. I mean, literacy was the divide, you know, between the population 100 years ago, 200 years ago, that the big distinction is, can you read or are you illiterate? Today, it's more about information literacy. If you want to see how educated society is, I encourage people to watch MSNBC or Fox News for an hour each night and watch these political debates and see if you can identify any candidate. Maybe there's one or two, but I guarantee all of the front-running candidates are not talking to any of the audience at more than a 6th or 7th grade level. So we don't have that that educated populace now. And I think one of the reasons why so many people don't have information literacy, they don't take the responsibility to evaluate information on their own, is because they have like 12 to 16 years of not using their minds as tools of evaluation, but using their minds as sponges for the words and the writings of authorities, because that's what they've been conditioned to do. School works like you sit there, you're a kid, you don't know anything. The person at the front of the room knows a bunch of stuff. The people who wrote the books know a bunch of stuff, and all you have to do is kind of sit there and passively absorb it. So the real problem that we have in society today is not literacy. I think it would almost take more of an intervention to stop a child from reading with the way information resources are available today.
Well, Brett, reading is a form of communication. It's a natural human instinct to want to be able to communicate. This is why children learn how to talk at early ages. And all we do as parents is really just guide them in pronouncing the words correctly. And reading and writing are forms of communication. And there is a natural desire there to want to learn how to do that if it's not interfered with. But Professor Kunzman, I don't mean to be specifically or purposely disagreeable, but I just it's inside my soul. I reject being regulated by a system that I don't feel is doing a good enough job. And I think that's why we're running into this dilemma. But I think that we can both agree that we want what's best for the country, and we want what's best for humanity. Can we agree on that? Even if we have different paths to get there.
I think we can agree on that. No, I think that again, I would not want to claim that, you know, I'm holding up a public school standard as what homeschoolers should live up to. And in fact, I think I tried earlier to reject that notion that what the public schools hold up as all their standards and content and things are what we should expect of homeschoolers. Rather, I'm trying to just hold up what I would say is a very sort of low bar of, you know, basic literacy and numeracy that's irrespective of what public schools are doing. I would expect the same of public schools, and I certainly think that just as folks who are not involved in homeschooling, those who sort of stereotype homeschoolers as all this or all that, I would reject that in the same way that I would also reject broad-scale generalizations about public schooling. I think there are plenty of public schools that do a wonderful job, and I think that again, it runs the gamut just as homeschooling does. And so I'm not interested in comparing one against the other per se, but rather saying what are the basic interests of children, and whether it's in public school or homeschooling, let's just think about how we can help make sure that those basic interests are met. And beyond that, I'm all for, you know, freedom and liberty and choice and being able to craft and guide that education whatever way seems best to individual families.
I guess the philosophical question that is being begged right now as far as regulation goes is we also want to make sure that children are eating a proper diet. We want to make sure that they're having ample playtime, that they're not spending too much time in front of the TV or they're not watching inappropriate programming. Should society set up a standard to regulate children's diet or TV watching?
No, I think that, again, to me, one of the questions then becomes can we find a general consensus around that? And I think there's such widespread, reasonable disagreement around those things that it would be terribly intrusive of the state to do that. To me, I just don't see the same issue around learning how to read and write.
Well, we do have an obesity epidemic in America. That's pretty clear. Children are very, very much more unhealthy now than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago. So there are a lot of people out there that would say, I just read an article online the other day that suggests that the state should impose eating restrictions on children. And they were attempting to take away obese children from parents because they felt the parents weren't doing a good enough job to keeping the kids healthy. So while we could say, well, that's different, that's eating versus educational neglect, we're still looking at the same basic principle here. Does the state have a right to say what's healthy and what's not? Clearly, these kids are not healthy if they're obese, but I'm not going to force myself into that and say, I'm going to take your kid away because you're just not doing a good enough job, just like I wouldn't force myself into a family that says your kid's 8 and they don't know how to read, so off you go. You know what I mean? That's the philosophical dilemma.
Sure, but your philosophical position is not – you're still on the spectrum, right? Because you still contend that there is a point at which children should be taken away from their families if they are abused.
If it's legitimate abuse,
well, yeah,
and there
but,
are
but
already constitutional laws on the books that protect that.
Well,
I mean, there's the definition of criminal and not the definition of criminal, and we have – a golden mean for that already. We have the Constitution.
Well, the Constitution does not specify the parameters of child abuse. It's drawn from the Constitution, just like most of our laws are, in terms of being able to decide what the specifics are. And so what I'm saying is that there's a spectrum of where everyone falls on a spectrum of where the state should intervene. And very few of us would say the state should never intervene in the family. Right? So then the question just becomes is where on that spectrum do we fall? And I would agree with you that we need to be extremely cautious whenever that we say that the state should intervene. And that's why I'm trying to be very cautious in terms of the educational milieu. And clearly, you know, you're falling farther along that in terms of state intervention. And that's, I think, the point of disagreement rather than an ultimate principle that the state should never intervene.
And what I would like to see is more and more conversations where we can talk about how the state doesn't need to be involved in any of these things at all. Now, we don't live in that environment today. But when we're talking about what Laurette just mentioned as far as seizing children from their families for being overweight, we see the dangerous effect, this sort of overreach that tends to happen with any government initiative or government projects. Now, in addition to my experience in education, I did spend a couple of years teaching history and, you know, kind of looking at the civics education that young people are supposed to get. Now, through this civics education, like I was mentioning before, you would think that the government is for the people and relatively responsive. And I don't want to turn this into a political conversation, but unfortunately, that's the world we live in today, where, you know, 10 years ago, we could have a conversation about getting on an airplane and going somewhere without it being a political conversation. 50 years ago, we could talk about our health without it being a political conversation. 100 years ago, we could talk about education without it being a political conversation. But as the state expands its reach into our lives, those things are not possible anymore. Now, through the civics education that children are supposed to get in school, I think a lot of adults wind up talking about government projects or things they want to see the government do the same way they would talk about like their own fantasy baseball team, where they get to make their lineup and decide who plays center field. And that's not reality. I think that people need to be looking at government projects and the propensity of these projects to expand and overreach the same way, not like fantasy baseball team, but like a fire. You know, like, do I really want to set this fire? Because that's what it usually winds up being. And I think that we're going to see, if nothing changes, we're going to see children being taken away because of, parental dietary choices or poor dietary choices that parents make for their kids. And I want to shut that door. If it means devoting more time and energy to deciding discovering how children could be helped or how children could be saved from abuse in a society where the government is not intervening, I think that's a conversation that needs to be had. I'm certainly trying to have those conversations in education, but it really concerns me when people have this idealized vision of state intervention and no one ever seems to recognize the overreach or the unintended consequences of the things they initially support. So that's where I'm coming from. And I'm not accusing you of, you know, saying that the government is a fantasy baseball team, but I'm thinking that that's how most people view it. Like, they can make it into what they want, and that's not reality.
This is an important dialogue.
Yeah, I certainly would. I try to be very respectful of homeschoolers' concerns around the idea that camel's nose in the tent or slippery slope for regulation. And I think that clearly, I mean, there is that danger. To me, philosophically, the principle would be, even though there is that danger, doesn't mean that the state has absolutely no role to play. But I do agree that great caution is called for.
Well, here's my thoughts. We have the Constitution where we went back to before, and we were trying to define what is criminal and what is not, because, you know, there is a difference between, yes, we do want to intervene when a child is being abused at home, but we have to make sure that we understand the key word is when. We intervene when a child is being abused at home, and we need to define what the parameters of that abuse is. We can't assume that educational neglect is, in fact, abuse, because it isn't necessarily. And again, our supreme law of the land, which is the Constitution, provides the definition for us. And we have the loss of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That is where the criminal behavior comes. When we interfere with someone's loss of life, liberty, or we interfere with someone's life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. The Constitution does lay out these definitions very clearly of abuse. So in which of those definitions, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, does educational abuse fit? Now, I'm assuming that you would say that we're interfering with the pursuit of happiness by not forcing a child to read. But then we come into the issue of force. Forced reading doesn't always work, but we are all allowing children to read. They have ample opportunity to be able to do that. Now, if a parent is keeping them locked up in a basement and not providing them with any books or anything, now, yeah, this can cross the line into abuse, because you can't really lock children up into a basement, can you? But my opinion is you can't really lock them up into a classroom either, and I would consider that abuse. So this is kind of the conundrum that we find ourselves stuck in. You understand? Am I making sense to you?
Well, you know, I think that I would also point to a question of liberty and the children of the liberty of children to be able to have options in life and to be able to become economically self-sufficient in a variety of ways would certainly be important as well. But you know, I think that you know, when you talk about the Constitution giving us clear guidelines on abuse, you know, every state has a different set of criteria for what constitutes abuse. And so, you know, I think that, again, it's about drawing interpretations toward the sense of what we're going to stand for as a society. And those are always conversations that we need to have, like we're having now, in terms of what those boundaries are. You know, and so to me, you know, when we talk about the basic interests of children, some of them the state can help to protect and some of them it's beyond their capacity or their prerogative to be able to do so. But again, I would come back to this as being one that I think the state has a role to play.
Now, coming back to what you mentioned before, that it should be comprised of the people. What do the people think? What do the people want? What do the people in that particular community feel as far as standardizing home education and regulating home education? Would you agree then that we should leave it up to each individual state and community to decide how they want to run their educational issues?
Well, I think that constitutionally that's how it's set up.
Exactly.
And so
we should leave it alone.
Yeah, I mean, I mean,
this is covered under the 10th Amendment, really.
I think there's all sorts of arguments about how much the federal government should be involved in education equalizing funding for special education and Title I and things like that. And I think there's some important things to consider. But in terms of the basic structure of regulation, the states decide.
So we can agree then that the fact that we have states with strict regulation and states with no regulation, that this is really the most ideal situation we can hope for at this point in time until we come up with a better plan.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly haven't given a lot of thought to whether it's the ideal, but it's the way it is, and I think that it's certainly addressing questions of homeschool regulation at the state level I don't have any sort of huge problem with that, certainly.
Right. Well, I'm of the opinion that I would like to see the Board of Education become non-compulsory. I don't think public education should be compulsory. I think that should actually be the option for families who don't feel that independent education is right for them, or schooling themselves or learning themselves or homeschooling or whatever term you want to give it. If they don't feel that that's right for them, they can't do it for economical reasons or any other reasons, then we have this option of going to these community learning centers. So I would like to see the paradigm shift in that way, just from an ideological perspective, that we see it is the parents' responsibility and it is a natural extension of parenting to help our children become educated. And if we feel that we need help, then we have these community learning centers with dedicated teachers and so on and so forth. I think that they should be very much run themselves, though, and by the community that they're in and by maybe the state that they're in, and it should not be a centralized, federalized government, because that's when we run into this issue of who gets to decide what the golden mean is, and we take it out of the hands of the community and we put it back on this general bureaucratic level that can't possibly have the individual's interest at hand. So to me, that would be the ideal situation when we're talking about education, and I'd like to see society move toward that. I think the way that we can get there is by sorting out all of the details and differences and philosophical differences that we need to sort out, and that's the purpose of having conversations like this and why I appreciate you being on the show today, Professor Kunzman.
Well, I've enjoyed our conversation. I thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, I think this has been educational for the audience, and I'm very glad that we've had it. Before we go, could you mention your website and your book and perhaps some contact information if anybody's interested in learning more about you and what you do?
Oh, sure. The book is called Write These Laws on Your Children, and the website, probably the easiest way to find it is just to Google the phrase homeschooling research and scholarship. Then it'll come up probably as the first choice there on Google. My contact information, it's rkunzman@indiana.edu. And I would certainly welcome input and further conversation.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much for joining us today. I really appreciate you coming on with us this early in the morning to record this podcast, and I hope to be working with you again sometime in the future. I think we had very intelligent and very useful conversation.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Professor.